treatment to reinforce the health systems.
Now that public health and social measures have been relaxed in many countries, COVID vaccination rates have slumped in some parts of the world, and authorities are worried. G20 health ministers have stressed that the public's vaccination is crucial.
The G20 talks have taken place against the backdrop of a flaming debate over the so-called Green Pass, a mandatory proof of anti-COVID vaccination. The Italian government is considering extending its Green Pass to all employees in the public sector, but part of the ruling coalition is against it.
The Italian government has already made the Green Pass mandatory for school staff and for passengers on long-distance public transport. This has prompted a swath of protests across Italy over the past months. About 37.5 million Italians, out of a population of less than 60 million, have received both COVID vaccine doses so far. Italian authorities aim at vaccinating 80% of the population by the end of September, a target that seems unlikely to be met. Max Civili, Rome.
The EU Rule of Law Report 2021 singles out Hungary, Poland, Bulgaria, Croatia and Slovenia for particular criticism. It reaches conclusions but provides zero recommendations.
It's toothless and spineless because what we have is a carefully worded partial account of threats to the rule of law without any joining of the dots, without any calling things out as they are.
The European Commission's Rule of Law report was published in July. This is the first opportunity members of the European Parliament, MEPs, have had to debate it. Some governments in the EU are accused of corruption, stifling media freedom and interfering in judicial systems.
Such as Austria, for example, where public prosecutors responsible for high-profile corruption cases have been confronted with negative portrayals by government representatives.
Calls have been made for EU funding to be withheld.
No money from the recovery plan can be used by these oligarchs to further capture the state and further organise elections in their favour. We should be very, very serious about that.
Far-right EU lawmakers were criticised during the debate.
You protect a Hungarian autocrat who gives money to everywhere there in dark channels in corruption.
Legislators say EU governments are failing to ensure human rights and promote religious tolerance. It's a particular issue for Jews and Muslims.
For me, Muslims are two times victims. One, as a citizen like you and me, but secondly, because their religion is hijacked by extremists who make a horrible thing of it.
The European Commission has powers to enforce rule of law, but is accused of not using them.
It is a problem for all of us. It's a problem because this spreads. And also, it's a problem when the Commission doesn't manage to act properly.
Some MEPs are asking the question, why is it EU leaders are so quick to apply sanctions on foreign nations for alleged rule of law breaches, but turn a blind eye when one of their own nations steps out of line? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Lebanon is in a day of national mourning after the passing of head of the Supreme Islamic Shiite Council in Lebanon at the age of 85. Sheikh Abdel Amir Qabalan was viewed by those who knew him as not only a religious figure, but a national figure who strove for the best interest of the country.
Lebanon's problem doesn't lie in its religious or sectarian diversity, but in some corrupt officials who hide behind their sects and call on their followers to move away from their genuine belief. Sheikh Qabalan, along with other clerics, exerted all efforts to keep the sectarian diversity as national treasure. Lebanon cannot be a transit area for the Zionists or the U.S. It should be a symbol of resistance and national pride as he wanted.
The deceased cleric was known for his moderation and therefore his impact on mediating talks between Lebanese political groups.
The demise of Sheikh Qabalan comes at a critical time for Lebanon, which is unprecedented in Lebanon's history. Lebanon needs such figures at this stage. He was someone open to all sides in Lebanon, whether political or religious. He had always called for solving our internal crisis peacefully. Also, he was a supporter of the resistance.
In a statement, the Speaker of the Parliament, Nabih Birri, stressed that Ayatollah Qabalan followed in the footsteps of Imam Musa al-Sadr in moderation, coexistence and resisting deprivation and occupation.
Sheikh Qablan's demise is a great loss for Lebanon and the Muslim world. We all know he was among the close companions of Sayyid Musa al-Sadr, and together they worked for the poor and the oppressed. They established the Supreme Islamic Shiite Council, which serves as a center for congregation and dialogue for all Lebanese. We pray that this sad occasion could push the Lebanese officials to put differences aside and quickly form a cabinet, since Lebanon is in dire need for an active government.
Caretaker Prime Minister Hassan Diab declared Tuesday the day of the funeral procession for the spiritual leader as a national holiday.
Throughout his life, Sheikh Qablan called on everyone to preserve the resistance in Lebanon and Palestine. He also preached unity among the Lebanese and Muslims, a move which made him a mediator on many occasions. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
As the world battles extraordinary refugee crisis for decades, hundreds of Afghans who have arrived in India after the Taliban take over of their country. They have been protesting outside the UN refugee office in New Delhi, demanding refugee status, justice, and protection for their women and children. Experts say India is not a signatory to the 1951 UN Refugee Convention or the 1967 protocols relating to the status of refugees. Therefore, it would be a challenging task to deal with another refugee influx. In India, where internal migration has been one of the most challenging tasks for the country due to huge population and possible mismanagement of the refugee policies. Observers say another refugee exodus could be a hard job for the country, considering its complex bureaucratic registration process. They say the country needs a uniform refugee policy. As India has no specific program for refugees, it allows the UNHCR to operate a program for them. Based on reports, thousands of Afghans are registered with the UN Refugee Agency, but there are many who are still demanding the refugee status despite arriving in India a decade ago. Experts say now the new influx might compel India to rethink its refugee policy.
Like many other nations and countries, India is home to a large group of and large chunk of refugees who come from their countries of origin to seek protection. But the confusion arises when we come to the mechanism, how India governs its refugees. In India, they have not a sound mechanism which can deal and which can protect these minorities.
A decade ago, scores of Afghan refugees arrived in India, leaving their war-torn country. But they still have trouble in accessing basic services like education, healthcare, and employment. Many are now demanding financial assistance due to lack of income. Others say they would return to their country, but are skeptical and still reeling from the violent past.
I think we have no future as the whole world is silent on our plight. The memories of violence still haunts us. I have a refugee card, but it does not help me as it should as a refugee. I urge the UN and the international community to pay urgent attention to us. We are worried for our future as our fate remains uncertain.
Despite India's rich history of ties with Afghanistan and home to hundreds of thousands of refugees from across the globe, the country has no clear-cut policy for refugees or any domestic law. Experts say by framing a concrete refugee law, India would be able to appropriately protect the rights of refugees. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Talks over the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal have faced a three-month hiatus following Iranian elections in June that brought Ebrahim Raisi to power. The European parties to the multilateral accord are now urging Iran to come back to negotiations. The new Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, says resuming the talks is on his agenda, but that they should not be held under Western pressure, and the U.S. must first lift all its sanctions against Iran.
We'll never run away from negotiations, but what the Westerners are trying to do, what Americans are trying to do, what they're pursuing is that they want to apply pressure. I mean, you could either have talks and dialogue, but at the same time, if you have pressure, well, what kind of negotiations are they? I mean, we need to have negotiations without pressure. That's not negotiation with pressure. So the threats that they are making against our people, these brutal sanctions, economic sanctions that they have impose. This is not the issue of negotiations that we're talking about.
Six rounds of talks on restoring the deal have so far been held in Austria's capital, Vienna, since April. The discussions are aimed at bringing the U.S. and Iran back to full compliance after Washington unilaterally abandoned the deal, and Tehran retaliated by scaling back its own commitments. The U.S. seeks a broader deal that would include Iran's missile program. But Tehran doesn't buy any such notion as negotiation for the sake of negotiation, says Iran's foreign ministry spokesman in his weekly briefing.
The Vienna talks are aimed at ensuring Iran's rights under the nuclear deal, which were violated by the U.S. lack of commitment and Europe's inaction toward the deal. So we are not negotiating a new deal.
Under the deal signed in 2015 between Iran and the six world powers, Tehran agreed to curb its nuclear activities in exchange for sanctions relief. In 2018, ex-U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew his country from the deal and reinstated sanctions on Iran. Tehran, in return, moved away from some of its obligations and resumed uranium enrichment to 20% purity. In the Vienna talks, Tehran vowed to reverse all of its retaliatory steps on the condition that Washington removes all its anti-Iran sanctions. The new Iranian administration has not given any specific date as to when it will return to the Vienna talks. But what's clear is that the fate of the nuclear deal is equally important for Raisi as it was for the previous government. Except it's not the first priority for the new Iranian president, as he doubts the U.S.'s sincerity in lifting the sanctions after six rounds of fruitless talks. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Another wide-scale operation was launched by the Yemeni army against the oil giant Aramco in several areas in Saudi Arabia. The spokesman of the Yemeni army said Yemen's air force has successfully targeted Aramco's oil facilities in Ras Tanura in Dammam with eight drones of Samad 3 type and a ballistic missile.
Our forces have targeted Aramco oil facilities in Ras Tanura in the Dammam region, eastern Saudi Arabia, with eight Samad 3 drones and a Zulfiqar ballistic missile.
Saria also added that Aramco's facilities in Jeddah, Jazan, and Najran were also successfully hit by five ballistic missiles and two drones of Samad 3 type. He then warned Riyadh against further attacks until the war on Yemen is stopped. Earlier, Saudi officials said they had intercepted ballistic missiles targeting eastern province as well as the cities of Najran and Jazan in the south. The attacks came in response to the years-long Saudi aggression against Yemen.
Yemen's army has no way but to intensify its attacks against Saudi Arabia amid the kingdom's aggression against the impoverished nation. Saudi Arabia uses all capabilities, targeting civilian areas in Yemen, destroying the country's infrastructures. The latest attacks by the Yemeni army serve as a tit-for-tat operation.
Saudi Arabia launched a deadly war against Yemen in March 2015, killing tens of thousands of civilians, most of them women and the children, and displacing millions more.
People here hailed the Yemeni army for its retaliatory attacks on Saudi Arabia. They say Saudi Arabia will remain a legitimate target for them as long as it continues its aggression against the impoverished nation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Come on. It's time to get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we're currently cruising over Iranian skies.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to The Spotlight. It is one of the biggest and most important yet maybe embarrassing jailbreaks. Six Palestinian prisoners escaping Israeli jail through a tunnel. Now, the Palestinian men who escaped the jail are seen as heroes, embarrassing for Israel, since they were able to escape a high-security Israeli jail, breaking the myth that Israeli prisons are inescapable. Meanwhile, Palestinians are holding them as heroes. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how this escape is emblematic of a major breakthrough in Israel's so-called invincibility, especially when it comes to its prisons and how this will embolden other Palestinians to stand up to the Israeli regime.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have celebrated the escape of six Palestinian inmates from Israeli maximum security Jabal prison in north of the occupied territories through a tunnel dug in the floor. Palestinians hailed the heroic operation and handed out candies to celebrate what they call a heroic move. Palestinian factions consider the escape as a slap in the face of the Israeli regime.
This operation is a great victory for our Palestinian prisoners, the resistance, and our Palestinian people. What happened in Jabal prison is unique. Our inmates grabbed their freedom by themselves, leaving the Israeli security defeated and confused. We are celebrating this victory as we call on all Palestinians to provide safety for those inmates.
Prisoners' groups said four of the inmates were serving life sentences. Another man was held under a special detention order, and the sixth was awaiting a verdict. Five of them belong to the Islamic Jihad movement, and one is a former commander in Fatah Party.
This escape has damaged the image of the Israeli regime before the world. It is such a great victory for Palestinians. We warn the Israeli regime against doing any action that puts the lives of those heroes at risk.
Palestinian resistance movements emphasized that the struggle for freedom with the Israeli occupation persists, both behind bars and outside.
This is the biggest prison break in the history of the Palestinian cause, and it's going to be a remarkable incident in history. As Palestinian resistance, we hail these inmates' efforts of grabbing back their freedom and breaking the Israeli chains. We warn Israel not to hurt those prisoners, or else this will cost the Israeli regime a lot.
Palestinians have praised the heroic escape of the Palestinian inmates, describing it a blow to the Israeli regime and its security. They also stressed that the resistance is the only way to defend their rights and liberate their lands. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Let me introduce our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight. We have Charlotte Cates. She's an international coordinator at Samadun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, who joins us from Vancouver. We also have Mick Napier, activist for Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, who joins us from Edinburgh.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both. And Charlotte Cates, let me first start with you. Looking at this Gilboa prison is the name, a high security facility that's located in northern Israel. And it's called the Safe. And yet you have the six Palestinian prisoners who escaped this prison. Does this constitute a rare humiliation for the Israeli security apparatus?
I think what this constitutes is an exposure of the lie that the technical advantage granted to the Israeli occupation by the unlimited financial and military support granted to it by the United States and other Western powers is actually an advantage that's able to stop Palestinian resistance. So certainly it's exposing the weakness and the rottenness at the core of the Israeli occupation over Palestine through the courage, steadfastness, and kind of humanity of Palestinian political prisoners. And so it shows that there is always hope for freedom and that oppressive systems are doomed to failure. So certainly, this is a moment of humiliation for the Israeli occupation. But it's also a sign of just how steadfast, resistant, and committed Palestinians are to obtain their freedom despite all the most difficult circumstances.
So the two vantage points that we have, Nick Napier, and, and I'm wondering which one you agree with, one from Israel itself, who said that the prison service, that this is based on an Israeli prison service official, who said the escape was a major security and intelligence failure. And then from the Palestinian groups, you have them saying that this was a heroic act that took place. How do you see this, McNapier?
I think in any colonial situation, the colonizer invariably has a massive technological advantage, whether in methods of killing or in methods of repression. But what determines the outcome, whether it's Algeria or Vietnam or even Afghanistan, is not that technological overwhelming superiority. It's the determination of indigenous people to persist and to resist, to absorb the terrible punishment that is inflicted upon them, as I say, in every colonial situation, and still to resist. And you know, in a struggle for existence, which the Palestinians are engaged in, morale is absolutely critical. It's not even weapons. It's not anything other than morale. And Palestinian morale took a huge leap during the recent Israeli attacks on Al-Aqsa Mosque and throwing Palestinian families onto the street in East Jerusalem and fascist gangs attacking Palestinians across 48 Israel. And the resistance that came from across the entire land surface of Palestine, the rockets from Gaza, the determination everywhere, forged a new sense of national unity and a readiness to resist. This is another. It's absolutely a disaster for the Israelis because they rely upon weapons that can kill to deter any opposition. And they also rely upon weapons of mass surveillance in order to crush the possibility of resistance. And you know, I think the Israeli salesmen who travel the world selling their grisly goods based on the fact that they've been tested on Palestinians and have been successful against Palestinians, their job in selling just became a little bit harder because armed with a rusty spoon, these six men got out of the Safe. And now it's become a national struggle because the honor of protecting these men from Islamic Jihad and from Fatah, and I'm not sure if there was any from Hamas, but nonetheless, you know, the honor of protecting and defending these men from the Israeli dragnet means it's a national struggle. And we hope they can escape into Jordan or somewhere else, but even if they can't, Israel has already been dealt yet another blow. And you know, recently when one of the killers on the Gaza border, and you know, they had been killing literally hundreds of unarmed Palestinians. Recently, when a fighter from Gaza managed to kill the killer, the Israeli government went into a kind of crisis. This has deepened their crisis, and I think once again has raised the morale of the Palestinian people. They still have a terrible price to pay to win their freedom, but this means their call upon the international community is much, much louder.
Well, Charlotte Cates, let's take a look at the six prisoners in terms of what charges were brought against them or not. And I say or not because we're looking at this policy that Israel has called administrative detention, where you have one definition says administrative detention is a preemptive measure that allows authorities to detain, Israeli authorities to detain suspects before trial. Then you have the other definition of this, in which it's basically stating that, let me bring this up, it's incarceration without trial or charge, alleging that a person plans to commit a future offense. And that is how many Palestinians actually get imprisoned, without committing something, but only suspicious that they may. Do you think that this process is legal?
No, I mean, administrative detention, which actually was introduced into occupied Palestine by the British colonial mandate and then was enthusiastically adopted by the Zionist regime, is routinely used by the Israeli occupation against Palestinians. There are currently approximately 4,650 Palestinian political prisoners in Israeli jails, and of those, over 500 are held without charge or trial in administrative detention. And it's important to note that when we speak about administrative detention, these orders are issued for up to 6 months at a time. However, they are indefinitely renewable. And so Palestinians routinely are jailed for years at a time with no charge, with no trial, with not even their lawyers being allowed to see what kind of alleged evidence there is against them on the basis of a so-called secret file. And this is absolutely illegal under international law. Even the elements of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which purport to allow for some forms of detention by an occupying power, do not allow for the routine and systematic use of administrative detention, which is absolutely what Israel has always practiced when it comes to Palestinians. The people who are targeted for administrative detention are community leaders, are freedom fighters, are organizers, are people who are looked to by their communities, by their villages, by their refugee camps, by their cities, as people who mobilize and defend Palestinian rights. And this is the entire reason why they are subject to arbitrary detention without charge or trial, something that is in complete violation of international humanitarian law and international human rights law, and something which is, right now, there are six Palestinian prisoners who are on hunger strike, one of them for nearly 2 months, in order to obtain their freedom from administrative detention, because administrative detention is also an element of psychological torture and collective punishment as well, because not only are you detained unjustly, not only are you detained by a colonial occupier, but you never know when you are going to be released or if you will ever be released. And your family is in that same situation as you. Many times families have prepared a dinner to welcome their loved one home from administrative detention, only to be told that he's not coming out because another 6 month administrative detention order is going to be slapped on him now. And so we see people like Ghassan Zawahra, community leader in Dehesha refugee camp, Kitan Safin, the president of the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees, dozens of Palestinian university students. These are the people who are being held under administrative detention.
Well, Mick Napier, I'd also like to get your reaction on this because, as our guests there indicated, detainments take anywhere from several months being in prison to several years, and perhaps even a lot more than that, without being charged, without telling them what they're being accused of. So give us your reaction to that. And I'm guessing that when this happens, well, what do you have? I mean, it's not like this happens once or twice a year. This is pretty much happening on a routine basis somewhat. You're getting a lot of Palestinians that keep accumulating in terms of their hate for the Israeli regime. They know that the Israeli regime is not light, but when they get that experience, not only the one that's being imprisoned, but also their family members. So, it kind of goes against establishing Israeli security with this act.
Charlotte's right about administrative detention. It's internment. It's snatching people from their homes and off the street without a semblance of a trial, and jailing them indefinitely in 6 month stages. But you know, the entire system in Israel means the so-called justice system, but it means that no Palestinian who's now incarcerated had received a trial in the sense that we would understand it. The system has a record of 99 0.7% conviction rate. For a Palestinian in this military system to be found not guilty is as rare as snow in summer. It doesn't happen. Let's say 100% conviction rate. That means that when a Palestinian goes in front of this court, his chances are zero. Her chances are zero. The only thing they can do is play the system and plead guilty in order to receive a reduced sentence. If they do not plead guilty, they'll have a sentence greatly increased. The court procedures will be dragged out for years. And I'm sorry, I forget the guy's name, but Mohammed, who's a humanitarian aid worker with World Vision in Gaza, is currently at the end of his fifth year awaiting trial on trumped-up charges of fraud, of which he is completely innocent, but he's in prison because he refuses to sign a false confession. That would be his only route out. He has been told if he signs the false confession, he can go free for time served. So the system is processing Palestinians like pieces of meat. They are not treated as humans, not by the court system and not by the staff in the court system. It only takes a Shin Bet guy sitting beside a so-called military judge to lean over and mutter the word security, and there's nothing the Palestinian can do. So this is not every single Palestinian in Israeli jails is a political prisoner. None of them has received a trial in the sense that we would understand it. It's a system of mass kidnapping and internment of thousands of people at any particular moment. And you know, a high-powered Zionist group of lawyers went to look at the court system in the West Bank several years ago and reported back to say it was indefensible. It was a system to terrorize Palestinians and to crush Palestinians into submission. That's from Zionist lawyers in London. So the truth is indisputable. These men who managed to dig their way out of Gilboa prison, they're just like the people who dug their way out of World War II prisons under Nazi Germany and any other brutally repressive regime. But you know something? The reason they won, the reason they got out, is because of the contempt and the racism with which Palestinians are dealt in the Israeli system, both popular racism and state racism. Uh-huh. Every Israeli learns that Palestinians are stupid or ugly or dirty or something horrible, and therefore they're treated with contempt. Well, now that contempt has led to these guys being able to get out of the safe. It's a tremendous slap in the face for this brutal system of mass incarceration, mass killing, mass house demolition, and a system, by the way, which Amnesty International says is characterized by systematic torture. So yeah, it's wonderful to see this. This is a time for parties and giving out sweets to your friends.
Right, and Charlotte Cates, our guest there, mentioned in the beginning that this is truly a booster for the morale of Palestinians. So when you and it's evidence based on the way the Palestinians have cheered this in the Gaza Strip and even in the occupied West Bank, and with the resistance groups coming out and really hailing this as a victory of sorts, you wouldn't think that this may have had that kind of impact, but it has had that impact. And this morale increase, how can that translate into what Palestinians' goals are when it comes to the Israeli regime in terms of trying to break obviously occupation and the different violations that occur there?
Well, this route through the Freedom Tunnel is in many ways a path to liberation of Palestine from the river to the sea. The Palestinian prisoners are so central to the Palestinian cause because they represent the resistance. They represent a true and uncompromised leadership of the Palestinian people, and they represent a real symbol of national unity that means more than just kind of discussions about governance or the Palestinian Authority, but instead are about the national unity that is obtained in fighting the occupation and resisting until victory. And so just as we talked about earlier, this shows that the technological superiority of the Israeli occupation can fall in the face of a determined indigenous resistance. And you know, this is what we've seen when the resistance on the ground has prevented the Israeli occupation from entering Gaza. This is certainly what we saw in Lebanon, when the resistance of the people drove out the occupation and forced it to leave. That despite that, you know, $3.8 billion of weaponry given to Israel every year by the most powerful army in the world, the United States, that does not stop the people of Palestine, just as it did not stop the people of Lebanon from liberating themselves. And so these six Palestinian prisoners are symbols of hope. They are symbols of the fact that liberation is not an idle dream, that liberation is possible, that it can be obtained, and that it can be obtained through planning, through strategy, through resistance, and through organizing themselves. And that's also the message that the Palestinian prisoners movement reflects as a whole. Right now, inside the prisons, there is an uprising going on. There are cells being burned in response to attacks by Israeli occupation forces. There are people taking to the streets throughout Palestine in support of these prisoners. So it's a moment of celebration, but it's also a moment of knowing that the struggle can be built and that victory can be achieved. And so it's also a symbol for everyone around the world who is looking for liberation, who is looking for justice, who is looking for freedom. These six men are representatives of the hope and the dreams of humanity in many ways. And so their continued freedom, the defense of them, and the mass embrace of the Palestinian people for not just these six Palestinian prisoners, but all of the nearly 5,000 held behind Israeli bars, reflects the fact that liberation is not only possible, but is in fact inevitable. But it can't come without all of us working, organizing, building the boycott of Israel, isolating the Israeli occupation regime, and building support and solidarity with the Palestinian people and their resistance.
Okay, final question to you. Going along the lines of what Charlotte Cates has said is obviously not something Israel wants to happen. So let's talk about the Israeli reaction here, what they're going to do. McNapier, as she mentioned, you got the Palestinian prisoners inside jails setting it on fire. Obviously, Israel doesn't want that. I'm guessing they're going to go out trying to crush this one way or another. It is said that their entrance into the Jenin refugee camp to look for the prisoners is imminent. There's going to be resistance there. Looking down further down the road, then are we looking at something happening between Palestinians and Israel because of this incident? How do you see it?
Well, Bennett, the Prime Minister, is an Arab killer. He said, I've killed lots of Arabs. I don't have a problem with that. The Israelis will be looking for people to kill because they have to restore what they call their deterrent edge and also to repress. So, yes, the Israeli response will be bloody and violent. But this resistance will inspire people around the world. Solidarity is only possible if people resist. The more they resist, the more the solidarity can be delivered. And this is an inspiration. We will now go forward to build a campaign, to intensify the campaign to boycott and isolate the state of Israel, because the Palestinians have shown that even if the Abu Dhabi and Riyadh, Israeli team, Cairo, obviously Britain and America aligning with the Israeli regime, nonetheless, the Palestinian resistance has not been broken, even although it's possibly the most unequal situation of any anti-colonial struggle in history. They show that they can win. It's a symbol, and it will lead to victory.
Thank you. Thank you. Unfortunately, got to have to end it, McNapier, activist Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Charlotte Cates, thank you. International Coordinator of the Samidon Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network from Vancouver. And that does it for this edition of The Spotlight. For me, Kavit Ahwe, it's goodbye. Until next time.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Health to terrorism. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the 8th episode of our series, Health Tourism. In this episode, we are going to introduce you a well-known hospital in Tehran, the Jam Hospital, and also the Bina Hospital, a well-known specialist eye ophthalmology hospital in the Iranian city of Mashhad, which is active in the International Patient Admission, or IPD, department. Please stay with us. Mashhad, the capital of Khorasan Razavi province, is the second largest city in Iran. The holy shrine of the 8th Shia Imam, Imam Reza, peace upon him, who is highly esteemed by Muslims, is also located in this city. For this reason, Mashhad is called the spiritual capital of Iran. The presence of the shrine of Imam Ali ibn Musa Reza, peace upon him, and many spectacular historical and recreational attractions has made this city one of the tourist hubs of Iran that annually receives thousands of pilgrims and tourists from all over Iran and the world. The shrine of Imam Reza, peace upon him, is located in the center of Mashhad. Some of the structures of this holy shrine date back before the Safavid dynasty and from the Timurid period, and even before that. But during the reign of Shah Tahmasp Safavid, many activities were carried out to expand the shrine. Therefore, this holy place is considered a large museum of Iranian architecture. In addition to being a pilgrimage city, Mashhad also benefits from many tourist attractions. One of these attractions is Mashhad Stone Mountain Park, which is very old and famous and is one of the most beautiful parks in Iran. This park is a combination of water, stone, greenery, and light. Other historical and scenic places in Mashhad include Malek Historical House, National Garden, Vakilabad Park, Haft Hoz Natural Park, St. Mesrop Church, and the tomb of Nader Shah Afshar. The city of Mashhad, with 2,226 accommodation units and dozens of direct flights to various destinations, is one of the tourism hubs of Iran. This, along with well-equipped hospitals and competent doctors, has attracted thousands of health tourists both from home and abroad to this city. They travel to Mashhad for treatment of various diseases and benefit from its excellent medical facilities. The city is historic, scenic, safe, and well worth a visit. In the remainder of this program, we will introduce you a specialist medical facility in the city of Mashhad, the Bina Eye Hospital, and we will become more familiar with the medical services and facilities offered and its IPD department. Stay with us. Bina Ophthalmology Hospital, with 7 floors, with a base of 9,500 square meters, was inaugurated on September 23, 2018. The hospital has 32 beds, 6 operating rooms, 2 laser operating rooms, and a specialized ophthalmology services. Bina Eye Hospital also has 19 inpatient rooms, of which 5 are single rooms and 14 are double rooms. In this medical center, 6 operating rooms with nano equipment and ophthalmology devices with the latest technology in the world for corneal diseases, contract, and other eye diseases have been provided. Bina Hospital has made to utilize the experience of ophthalmologists and in order to cure diseases related to the cornea, retina, glaucoma, strabismus, and eye aberrations. Eye surface diseases, different types of eye and tear duct allergies, DCR, cosmetic eye surgeries, and neuro-ophthalmology, and in other words, all eye diseases, so that the patient does not need to go to other medical centers. One of the departments of Bina Eye Hospital is the International Relations Unit. This unit has been established in order to provide services and increase the satisfaction of foreign patients and their well-being. Due to the high quality of medical services, the low cost of treatment, state-of-the-art equipment, and up-to-date world-class ophthalmologists and physicians, many medical tourists come to this hospital for treatment. These tourists are mostly from Iran's neighboring countries, such as Tajikistan, Republic of Azerbaijan, Turkmenistan, Iraq, Pakistan, and even some European countries, such as Sweden and Germany. The International Patients Unit of the Eye Hospital manages and facilitates all matters related to the treatment of foreign patients before the patient enters Iran until they're discharged from the hospital. The IPD team of the Eye Hospital is composed of international patient experts, English and Arabic translators, experienced doctors and nurses, and provides the best facilities to patients so that the patient has complete satisfaction during his treatment in Iran. The patient or the health tourist can be admitted to the Eye Hospital either by going to the hospital in person, via phone or online, or refer to the facilitation companies and obtain required information about the cost of treatment in the hospital. The city of Mashhad, with its competent physicians, committed medical staff, and up-to-date and modern equipment, has a large share in the Iranian health tourism industry. Of course, the presence of pilgrims has also been very effective in increasing the health tourism of this city. Bina Eye Hospital, which is a new and well-equipped hospital of its kind, has been very popular among foreign tourists, despite the short time that has passed since its establishment and operation. Dear friends, for more information about Bina Eye Hospital, you can visit the website of this hospital at www.ehbina.com or http://ehbina.com/pages/English homepage or call 0098-5136163 and get information on how to admit in this center. The hospital's email is info@ehbina.com, which is, of course, another way to contact Bina Hospital. Dear listeners, that was the 8th episode of our series, Health Tourism. Until our next program, goodbye and God bless.
Good morning!
from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.